This is a Pinball News production.
Well, the first one thing that my wife Melissa pointed out to me about our museum that's pretty cool that I, you know, when you're sitting in the thick of it, you just don't see these things. People come into our museum and they kind of, it's almost like water finding its level. They just spread. If a family comes in, occasionally they'll group around a machine and they'll explore it, and then they kind of filter off, and they each find their own thing that they're interested in. And I worked at the Exploratorium, and I used to go on the floor there and watch people, and they'd kind of struggle with an exhibit here, bang on some buttons here and there. And it was, and I always loved the Exploratorium, but I noticed that it wasn't a real easy thing to get into. You know, you had to work hard. With our place, it's great. You've got all this eye candy. You got all this art on the back glasses, and it was designed to catch your eye. I mean, so it works. It always did work. So that's what's incredible about it. Makes it a little bit easier in doing a museum like this, because it pretty much it's self-attracting, and it distributes the load evenly. People just kind of spread out and find and explore their own little whatever they want. Some people come up and they want to know about some of these early machines, like why is that one got, you know, nails in it, you know, and they want to understand the evolution of it. We have that on display. Some of them make a beeline for the new games. That's all they want to do is play a new game. But most of them come through the front where we have older machines and they learn how to play them. And after 3 years of that, I've been noticing that at our show here at the PPE, that they're playing them now. The machines where everybody complained, oh, there's not enough new machines. Well, now I notice that people are playing the older machines, and that was a huge success for us. The other thing that's incredible is that, as Larry pointed out, we have 22 murals up there, and we have a mural program now. We wrote a grant and got a matching grant. We raised $8,000. They matched it with $8,000. So now we have a slush fund to pay artists for even more murals. And there's a lot out there to do. We have Dan Font started the program. Ed Castle joined it. Eric Koss came on board. And now Darcy Bruno and Rosie Morales. Rosie Morales are doing some of the incredible ones. Like they did the Slick Chick out there, which is quite a masterpiece when you look at it. Even if you think of it as a back glass, you still got to look at it, and it's an amazing painting, the detail behind it. When the Clear Pinball got sold, it was not sold as an exhibit. It was sold as an art piece, strangely enough. That's how they look at it. And it had been in a few art galleries. That was a pretty big achievement to get something like that in there. Because the Exploratorium's a world-class organization, and for them to pick one of our pieces is pretty incredible. The other thing that does is it really puts it out there. We've been doing a strong campaign trying to get people interested in pinball, with the little juju going all around, putting the Clear Pinball out there, doing all these events, and it's paying off. People are finding out about us. We do Groupons, which might hurt us a little financially, but it gets the word out. There's a misnomer about that you have to pay to go into the museum. And I know a lot of people are going to hate it when I say this. You don't have to pay to come into the museum. Anybody can come in and look at and go through the museum. The only time we charge you is if you want to play the machines. So we go way beyond the call of a nonprofit museum, because we will let anybody into our museum and we will gladly explain anything about any machine, and they can stay there until they push that start button on a machine. And then they gotta pay. And that's our way of spreading pinball love, pinball info on this. We also have a community library program where we have five counties around Alameda County. They all have libraries that offer a family program. So every day, up to 20 people come in free from this library system to our museum. And we, you know, we eat all these costs. So we give away quite a bit to the community. I don't know how many free passes we give away to schools, to fundraisers, and things like that. And I know some people have a problem with the coin, you know, coin versus admission method. The coin method is great. We would make a lot of money. I would love to do it. It's a little bit more hassle, but the payoff is huge. The disadvantage is it's illegal in our town. You cannot run a coined pinball machine. You can run one in a bar, but you can't run one with just pinballs. So we're stuck. We get around it in one sense. We have coin new machines up front, where if you are a player and you want to come in and play some of the new machines, we have them up front, and you can play them to your heart's content. All the ones behind the rope require an admission, and that's kind of our way of serving both classes of pinball people. So when you come to our place, you get more than just playing pinball. You get an experience. You get the experience of everything that pinball is, not just the game, everything behind it. And we have all this information available, and we disseminate it as much as possible. One of the other things that we do that's kind of neat is working with people like Wade Krause and Dirty Donnie and Tanya Kleiss, Jerry Ellsworth, to make art out of these things. Dan Kramer also gets involved. And they make one of the first things Wade and I did was the Visible Pinball. And then they did the helicopters together, and they did some work for Metallica. And this has kind of spurned this whole movement now. I don't know if you noticed, but everybody's like getting excited about making their own pinball machines. And it's kind of what the reason I got into this was I always thought pinball was an art form. Now they're making kind of the paint kit for pinball. It's basically they're creating tools that allow you to program your own your own computer to make your own game. They have routers available, and things are, the whole Maker Faire movement is allowing people to make their own pinball. And this is exciting not only for players, but for artists who are making all sorts of crazy stuff. And I can't wait to see what's going to happen with this. And it's not only going to explode on the... it's already kind of gone quite a ways in the video realm, in the virtual pinball realm, but also in the physical realm, it's going to get crazy because there's more and more things that become available. So the next project was the Freedom Project to demonstrate... it was part art, more science, to take the same pinball machine that was made out of an electromechanical, and they made the first electronic machine. So we made that, and that's going to be going into the museum pretty soon. We're working on a set of exhibits that a particular museum actually requested. They got interested in the Visible Pinball machine. They said, well, what else do you have? So I laid out all these plans for pinball-related exhibits, and they got real excited. So it looks like we're going to be developing a set of pinball exhibits that will be leased to other museums. And we hope to continue this, basically taking what were exploratorium science exhibits that explain things like magnetism or gravity, vacuums, all sorts of things. And we're using pinball to do that. And the reason pinball is, A, it's cool. You can use the pinball graphics to make it more exciting and fun. But pinball machines, they get the shit kicked out of them, and they keep on ticking. And I, as a exhibit repair person that gets sent all over the world to fix science exhibits that little kids beat the crap out of, I came back with the idea, wow, wouldn't it be cool to just build them out of pinball machines, and then they'd last a little longer. So that's kind of where that's coming from. Then we got into, I need to catch up on this thing, sorry. The next one is, then we started getting into documenting the history, and that's where Larry comes in.
Yeah, most recently, a couple of years ago, we decided to embark on a Pioneers of Pinball series where we were going to document actual interviews with actual designers and artists of pinball, so we could preserve them for future generations to come, not just for current generations of pinball enthusiasts. Wayne Nyans, who I referenced earlier, designed over 160 games in over a 50-year career with Gottlieb. It's unfortunate that he wasn't able to be here tonight. He's 94 years old. He wanted to come out and see our show. It would have been the highest number of wood rail games that he ever created, all under one roof, operating at one time. So it's disappointed that he couldn't see that. But it's really important because if we don't preserve this kind of stuff, this kind of knowledge, this oral history, as it were, it's going to be lost forever. I mean, just earlier this year, Steve Kordick, who designed so many games at Williams, died at age 101. How is he going to tell his stories now? Who's going to know about his stories? These guys are gone, they're gone forever, and the information goes with them. So we want to really create a valuable research database, not only for today, but literally for future generations to come. So far, we've made two films on Wayne Nyans. The second one that was produced just a few months ago is going to be screened, it was screened yesterday. I don't even know what day it is today. We've been kind of busy with the show. And we've also got Gordon Hosse walking around explaining the rule sets and criteria and basic history of a lot of wood rail games, so that's really interesting, too. We want to expand that. Yeah, so we've told you a little bit about the science. We've told you a little bit about the art and the history, and that's all a function of the museum itself. Now, as an adjunct of that, the Pacific Pinball Museum, is a sponsor, and we put on this Pacific Pinball Exposition. As I said, this is our sixth one. This year we've got close to 400 machines going back from 1898, early 20s, 30s, where wood whales, wedge heads, all the way up to solid states, DMDs, the most recent X-Men, and then recently unveiled just this morning, The Wizard of Oz from Jersey Jack. We, like other pinball shows, have seminars, too, on pinball art and history and repair and design. And then the back glass murals, capturing literally pop culture in the country at the time. And we have science exhibits. If you go back to our historical section toward the rear end of the hall on the left side, you've seen some interesting exhibits to teach kids about magnetism and electricity, gravity, and various things we have on loan from the Exploratorium. So a very strong collaboration with them. And we actually have tournaments for all different classes of players. So that's fun, too, and that attracts a lot of people.
So besides the PVs that we do, we also put together shows that we have out in the community during the year. Melissa and David Vilansky curated a few shows, and we get a lot of volunteers to come in and help. We did Pinball Oddity, which was a really cool show that just featured rare machines. Some of them are out on the floor. And some of the murals and some of the smaller stuff, the smaller murals that Ed Castle has painted. And then David and Melissa put together a whole thing on Bagatelle, and I swore I'd never see a pachinko machine in the museum, but sure enough, there was a pachinko machine in there. And I actually played it, and, you know, it was fun, got to admit. So it was Bagatelle, pachinko, and Peggle. And Peggle is kind of the digital version of Bagatelle and pachinko. So it was kind of neat. It showed a really cool evolution from the very simple, you know, marble and nail game all the way up to this digital version of this thing with, you know, incredible colors. And when you get the ball in the right place, it plays the Ode to Joy and all these fireworks go off. I mean, I got addicted. I was thinking that people would go around later going, Peggle, Peggle, Peggle. I didn't get sucked in that far, though. But it was pretty incredible. Ed Castle put together the murals and got together with Uptown Body in Oakland and did an incredible show of the murals in there. It just blew people away. And this is during the Art Murmur, which is the first Friday in Oakland. I don't know if you ever heard about it. It's world famous at this point, where the street's just a mob of people looking at art. And the murals there were a huge hit. Rock, Paper, Scissors, another gallery about a year later, same thing. Oakland's art, what they call the Art Murmur, and just an incredibly successful show. I've been taking a little juju down to the night market at Jack London Square, and that's got to be one of the best ambassadors of pinball ever. When people come up and see this big, shiny trader that looks like a robot loaf of bread that's in a hurry, and it's full of jingle-jangle pinball machines, and it's sitting on legs. It's got hydraulic legs, so it levels itself. They're just like, what the hell is that? You know, sometimes we're doing private parties like we did at Bar Mitzvah in Oakland, and people were just walking by, and they got to stop. Well, what is this thing? You know, and here it's our card. And, you know, so we're handing out cards all the time, telling about the expo, telling about the museum, just spreading pinball love all over. The Maker Faire is another huge one. That's probably our biggest. We go there, and this isn't done by, you know, this is a lot of people putting this together because it's a burnout. It's a huge thing. As soon as we open the doors, the little juju just packs, and we had it surrounded with two clear pinballs, all this other stuff that we've made, and it's just a huge saturated commercial for pinball, and it has had an effect. I think everybody can agree. Pinball's on the rise in the Bay Area. I know we can't take all the credit for it, but we're going to take a lot of it because we've been working really hard on this, and I think we deserve that. I talked a little bit about the murals grant, and if you are interested in getting a mural done, you can put one up for a vote. Basically, the artists get to be the ultimate choosers, so think like an artist before you make a pick for that. Eric has been cranking out murals really quickly, and he just finished the last one right before we came to the show, which was Card Whiz. Paint's barely dry on that one. And it's incredible. And Dan and Ed, Eric, and Darcy, they're just incredible at how they work at this stuff, and it takes them months to paint these things. And I'm not sure, but I think a lot of people come into the floor there, and they think they're just big prints. They have no idea that these things took months and that they're hand painted. But anybody who would go up and look at it closely would obviously see how much goes into it. And that's part of what we do. And it's also on their part is incredible that they do this for us, because basically our arrangement is we give them some seed money and some material money, and then they go and paint it. We don't own them. They own them. If they can sell them, and we get our seed money back. We get to use them in the meantime, and we try and advertise them. So if you've ever needed that nice mural for your special game room, now's the time to get them, because they're going at bargain prices right now, I'm telling you. So the other thing we do is a lot of community service. And the reason we had to use these generic photos is because all mine were blurry. But we do a lot with Girls Inc. They've been coming there since day one. And it's really a lot of fun to get little kids in there playing pinball, because you can see it happening. You can see them go up to that machine, and then they figure it out. They pull that plunger back, and they're experiencing pinball like we experienced it if we did when we were kids. And they get enraptured, and they get that bond happens. I've literally seen it happen not only at the museum, but out on the floor here when a grandfather comes in and with his grandson. Grandfather probably hasn't played a pinball machine in 30 years. Grandson's never seen one. And somehow they are bonding together on a machine or a couple machines playing against each other. And it just really, I mean, I was broken to tears one time. It was just like, I was looking at it, and it just really melted my heart to see that. To see that not only was it were we carrying on this thing that we love, but it was actually making this bond, a familial bond. And that's another key thing that our museum does, is we encourage families to come in. I think other places, they don't really care. Just come on in. We really want families to come in. That's why we do the library program. We want families to come in, and we want them to have a good time. And on top of that, we'll even bend the price of admission. If somebody has a hard time paying it, then my wife's all too eager to chop the price down. But it has a good effect. The long run is that we are exposing it to more and more people. And yeah, it might not be good business sense, but it makes good sense in the long term. So I'm going to turn it back to Larry.
So for those of you who haven't actually been to our museum in Alameda, near Oakland, California, just these few pictures here, slides show exactly what the museum looks like when you walk in the front door. We have a kiosk where people pay an admission price to get in. The machines are all set on free play. We have in-and-out privileges. We're open 6 days a week till midnight Friday and Saturday. And what we see in the front room are earliest historical games dating back to the late 1800s, the earliest bagatelles, a couple of those, a baffle ball, a bumper, bally bumper, 1936, first game with bumpers, Humpty Dumpty, first game with flippers, 1947. So some very important milestones to show people how pinball has evolved over the years. I think a lot of people coming in contact with pinball for the first time don't realize that these things have been around for not all that long. It's only been 100 years or so, a little over 100 years, but they have evolved, and it's interesting how they've evolved. I hope some of you or if you've all got a chance to see the historical section that we have at the show this weekend. You can see it for yourself. Again, we don't want to put these things behind velvet ropes like automobile museums. And go, oh, look at the cool chrome on the Duesenberg, you know, or through glass cases. They were meant to be played, enjoyed, and interactive. They're kinetic sculptures, as it were. That's part of the whole visceral experience. As you move into the museum, you can see our amusement gallery, where we have things like a bally spinner and various oddball things like the ringer, the Williams ringer, the horseshoe game where you turn a wheel, and we just don't know how to classify things like that, or bally circus, or the little bit of the science now. We have the clear pin there, but we really want to display that in our art gallery in the center of the room, where we have various exhibits, either as pinball as art or art as pinball. And then we have rooms dedicated strictly to the solid-state machines. Can't imagine why anyone would want to play a DMD or a solid-state game, but they do. People really like this stuff. I can't imagine why. And then we do have other rooms that are dedicated to EMs and games from the 60s and 70s, which are nearer and dearer to my heart. Now, I mentioned earlier that we have some interesting news as we evolve and move forward, and that is that, as many of you know, after 6 years of putting on this show, we've come to the realization that what we really need to do now is focus our energy and our efforts at getting a permanent home that's much larger than our current home. I mean, we have 700 machines in the collection now, estimated to grow it up to 1,000, perhaps 1,500 machines in the next 3 years. We have no place to put all the games that we have now, at least to display them all. What we really need is a larger destination, permanent, and it really needs to be not in the East Bay, right? We've been in Alameda since day one. We've looked at Oakland. We've looked at Berkeley. We've looked at various sites in Emeryville. They're just not destinations. People don't go there from out of town. What we need is a successful demographic, I think, as Tim experiences in Vegas, is tourists. It's not just locals that keep you in business and thriving, not just getting by, but actually thriving. We get locals and we get hardcore pin fanatics, two of the three pieces. The third piece is tourism, and the only way we're going to do that is to be located in a major metropolitan city, and San Francisco has become now at the top of our list. We have certain sites in mind, but at the very top is the Palace of Fine Arts. This is a building that's very beautiful to look at. And if you look at it closely, you can see it actually already has a pinball on top of the dome there. And it's not chrome. It's actually marbleized like it would have been in the early 20s or 30s. This building was actually erected for the Panama Pacific International Expo back in 1915, sort of equivalent to a world fair. And about 8 or 9 buildings were actually erected for that expo, and this is one of the 8 or 9 that was left standing. The Maytag family had a lot to do with that expo, by the way, of washing machine fame. So the Exploratorium, the hands-on science museum that we've talked about a little bit, has been there since 1969, 43 years. It's one of the nation's first science, art, and human perception museums. If any of you have ever been there, the interactive exhibits are really, really interesting for adults and kids of all ages. Last year, the Exploratorium drew 560,000 visitors. Of that, 60% to 65% were actually from California. Another 10% were from out of the country. And their breakdown is, the demographics is about 60% adults, 35 or 40% kids. About 22 to maybe 25% of the visitors actually became visitors. Members. And that's another thing we have in mind, is to have memberships for different family levels. And it's about 132,000 square feet. And if you've ever been here, there are beautiful, stunning views of Golden Gate Bridge and Crissy Field right nearby, just across the small street there. So it really is a world-class tourist destination, as it were. People likely to go to San Francisco from the East Coast will come to downtown, maybe the Museum of Modern Art, maybe go to the Jewish Contemporary Museum or various art museums downtown. But chances are they're not going to rent a car and drive across the Bay Bridge to Alameda just to see a pinball museum. But if we were in San Francisco, they wouldn't have to do that. Now, we've taken a quick look at the numbers of exactly how many visitors we would need to make the numbers work in terms of our costs. It works out to somewhere between 5 and 10% visitors per day or week or month, or whatever you want to, however you want to measure it, than the Exploratorium gets. I think we'd be able to do that. We would get not only tourists by the busload, but lots of kids coming on field trips, just like we do now. It's about 132,000 square feet. Maybe 82,000 square feet of that is available, because the Exploratorium is moving out of this home, and they're moving to Piers 15 and 17 starting in December of this year. By the middle of next year, they will have moved completely. The city of San Francisco, which owns the building, it's under the purview of the Rec and Park Department, is talking about carving this space up into thirds, maybe half. We would love to have 35 to 45,000 square feet, which would be double of what you have here at the Expo Hall, to have everything we talked about, 400, maybe 500 games on display, restoration classroom, oral history section, restaurant, gift shop, merchandise, etc. But again, we've had preliminary discussions with the city of San Francisco, and we are not the only people, or the only organization that are in the running for this space, because it's very desirable, obviously. We should know sometime in the next 6 to 12 months whether we've been selected as a tenant of this. But it'd be really, I think, just fantastic. I can't imagine a better spot to be in as a permanent home. One of the second choices would be in the Presidio. If you're familiar with the Presidio section of San Francisco, it's also very close to the Golden Gate Bridge. Right now in the Presidio, a lot of former buildings that were occupied by the Army are being redeveloped and repurposed. There's the Walt Disney Family Museum that's there. It's been there about 2 years now. It's been very successful. There are buildings adjacent to them, and I imagine that there would be people that have a ticket to go see that. Maybe they have an hour or two to kill, and they say, hey, honey, why don't we go take the kids to the pinball museum while we're here, while we're waiting? That's a possibility. Another possibility is down at the wharf. There are several piers there between Pier 39 and Pier 45. There's a successful Musée Mécanique that has a lot of things like dioramas and just sort of coin-op mechanical devices like that. The problem is the space there is very limited, and you're near some pretty salty air. It's not good for pinball machines. Another reason why we're really looking at focusing on fundraising efforts and to get a new home is because this show is really a lot of fun to put on. I mean, for 3 days, it's a gas. And not just as a visitor, but as an organizer and a participant. This thing is really, it's like nothing else. But the reality is, when you move 400 pinball machines, it's not good for the machines. It doesn't do them any good to get banged up and dinged around and moved and set up and then put on three semi-trucks, taken apart off the trucks, set up, take them down again, put them on the trucks, put them back in the warehouse. It doesn't do them a justice. It's not fair to them. And it's also not fair to the machines to not be moved. In other words, the 600 or so games in our collection that are literally standing on their ends, off their legs and with their heads, sitting in the dark in a storage warehouse. It's not fair to them. They need to be set up, and they need to be played and enjoyed. That's when the problems creep in, is when they're sitting there and not being used. We want them to be used and enjoyed. That's why we really do need to make this move. And we think it's, as we evolve, it's we don't really have a choice. I mean, we could stay in Alameda. We could put on this really cool show every year and kind of, you know, make money every year and get by. But that's not enough. We want to be literally the Smithsonian. We want to be the authority of pinball, art and science and history and pinball, preserving pinball. That's our mission statement. That's what we do. And this is the best way we think we're going to be able to do that. I think I've already gone through this slide just now. But that's, you know, by putting on the show, it really does detract a lot of energy and a lot of effort that we really should be spending building more science curriculum, making more community outreach programs, and frankly, fundraising. We've never really had a coordinated fundraising effort. We've always been too busy having fun acquiring and restoring games. It's not our emphasis, making money. Yeah, it's cool. It's great if you can. But I don't think most nonprofits make money in the first place. That's really not our goal, is to see how much we can make. It's more like, at least in Mike and I's experience, it's more fun just to focus on, hey, look at this machine I got last week, or look at this latest thing that we restored and put into the collection. That's been our focus, not the capitalistic or the you know, just the benefit of making money itself. So what we've done is we've this first fundraising effort of ours, we're trying to raise $1.5 million, and the website is called Indiegogo.com. And you can go there and you can contribute anywhere from $5 to $25,000. You get various little perks along the way if you do that. So one of the, as you're sitting here tonight in the audience and asking yourself, well, how can I help? Maybe I can't help financially, but maybe I work for a corporation who would be willing to donate to a cause such as ours. Maybe you work for a foundation or know people that work in a foundation. You can help us spread the word with them. Do you know an individual who's a grant writer or a professional fundraiser? Send them our way. We'd be happy to talk to them. We really do need your help as on a sort of a grassroots level. Your deduction as a 501c3 to us would be tax deductible. And if you want to, I think Mike referenced it before, but if you'd like to purchase one of the murals and you don't have room to put the mural in your house, no problem. We can hang it in the museum and put a little plaque that says, this mural donated by Tonio Kleiss. It'd be great. And part of the sales price, 25% of the sales price, would go to the artist. So it's a win-win.
So we got into this Indigo fundraiser when we looked at, somebody started a page called, Let's Build a Goddamn Tesla Museum. And they raised $1.8 million in less than 2 weeks. So we thought, well, they had no building, they have no plan other than the building was going to become available. This was Nikola Tesla's old laboratory out in New York State. I think it's called White Cliff or something like that. And that's where Tesla did his experiments up until when he went broke, I guess. And it burned to the ground. They want to buy it. They're going to try and buy it and do a Tesla museum. So that's it. That was their plan. So Eric Koss and I looked at that and said, well, we got more than that. We got a bunch of machines. We've been developing all this material. We've got all these artists doing this incredible murals. We've got all these volunteers. We've got 10 years of track record. Why can't we do that? You know, why can't we start an Indigo fundraiser? So that's what we did. The idea is to get a war chest together, to get some funds together, because we have been putting money aside. You know, we generate a little excess from running the museum, and we're not quite as thrifty as Tim, but we're pretty thrifty. We don't we like to be able to spend money on certain things, but we save as much as we can. So we've saved a small little pile because it costs so much to do this and everything that we do. So now we have to reach outside in the pinball community and outside of the pinball community, because it's going to take a lot to build a pinball museum of this sort. This would only be, like I said, a war chest that would allow us to go to the powers that be and say, look, we're serious. We really want to do this. We, I believe they showed up at the show today to actually see what our organization does, because when we approached the Palace Fine Arts people, they thought, wow, this would fit in nice here. And they actually came down to inspect and see what we're doing. So one basic thing you could do is if everybody could find somebody else to put $5 in, it wouldn't take too long. It would take a lot of people, but if you could spread the word and just kick in $5. If you can do more, that'd be awesome. If you know somebody who might be interested in what we're doing, please spread the news. The only way this is going to happen is if we do it. At a certain point, we will be able to really go after grants and other funding like that. But it takes so long, and you have to do so much work to get to that point. And we're getting there, but we're not there quite yet. And we are going to reach out. I like to believe that we don't really reach out and ask for help much, because we've always been kind of self-sufficient. And we're proud of that. And we've done all this work in order to get it to this point. And now we are going to ask for help, because this last leg of the journey is the hardest one. So here are some of the friends of the Pacific Pinball Museum that have already helped us, and we really appreciate everybody's help. It's incredible. The pinball community is an incredible community. They will go to all sorts of trouble to get somebody a plastic part for their pinball machine or a missing coil. I've always been amazed at how the pinball community just is. It's amazingly tight. There's a lot of drama sometimes. There's a lot of some little fighting here and there. But generally, I think we all love to help each other, and we all love to share our games with each other and our experiences. It's a pretty unique group of people. But unfortunately, I don't think that alone will build this museum. And not everybody in the pinball community is going to be interested in the museum. That's another reason we have to reach outside, because the people that we try to get into the museum are ones that aren't exposed to pinball. They don't know about it, but they know museums, and a lot of them like to go to museums. And they when they hear pinball museum, they go, well, that's odd, but let's try it out. And it's amazingly successful. We've been doing it and getting like 4.5 stars on Yelp. We were 5 stars for the longest until one of Tim's friends came in and slammed us. Or maybe it was Tim. I don't know. No. But yeah, if you look at the reviews, we're very successful, and we're solvent, and our concept is permanence, and that's real key. We are laying a foundation for future generations. Larry and I aren't going to be fixing games in our 80s, are we, if we make it that long? I hope.
Maybe 70s, I hope.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't want to. We're donating our games to this museum. I think one reason that this is all at all possible is because I can actually walk away from a pinball machine. And that sounds weird, but I think a lot of people are so entwined that they can't walk away from them. And so they'll never get to the point where they can do a serious museum. I've got to the point where I don't have to own every machine. I think it'd be interesting to have it in a collection, but I have no interest in owning any of this stuff. I have an interest in sharing it. And Larry, fortunately, came on board with the same attitude. It's just like, yeah, it's really cool. Let's share it. And so that is pretty incredible.
Yeah, sharing the experience is really what it's all about. It's not about how many you can acquire, but because I remember how much fun I had growing up as a kid, ages 5 through 12. My mom used to take my brother and me and my grandmother and our dog to Santa Cruz. We lived in Fresno, California, and we'd stay there for a week. And every day, my brother and I would be at the Coconut Grove Arcade playing pinballs all day long. We'd swim a little in the ocean because it was Santa Cruz and all, but we basically got hooked on pinballs there, and those were some of the happiest days of our lives, I can recall. And I know how much fun pinball playing was and is for me, and I want to share that with other pinball enthusiasts of all ages. So, again, ask yourself, what can I do to help these guys out? Even if I don't have $10,000 to be a silver ball angel donor. Well, you can be an ambassador for pinball. Keep coming to pinball events. Go to pinball shows. Go to pinball museums. Go all around the country. See what other people are doing. Talk to your friends about pinball. Hey, pinball's pretty cool. Social network, Facebook, Twitter. You tell your friends. They tell their friends. Pretty soon it grows virally and exponentially. Tell people about, what we're trying to do. No, that's okay. That's all right. Again, the whole reason why this works, this whole structure of what we're trying to do works, is really because of the passion, dedication, and energy and timeless devotion to what it is that we believe in, the cause that we believe in. This is our board of directors. I think you probably know a lot of these folks and probably recognize them out on the show floor. Say hi to them. Thank them for what they're doing. And speaking of thanks, make sure you thank anyone wearing a volunteer T-shirt. This show doesn't happen without the help of 85 to 100 different, very dedicated volunteers. So, again, thank you for coming, and thank you for taking interest in what we're doing, and please help us out any way you can. We can... Yeah, we should. Do we have time for question and answers, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Randy.
Did I understand you to say something about 8 to 10% of what the museum is currently doing at Exploratorium, you would require in order to survive at that location?
In order to break even, based on what we think our rent would be, we would need to draw somewhere between 5 and 10% of the Exploratorium's visitors per year. And I think we can, for example, if the number is 180 visitors a day, I think we can do that if, let's say, 60 of them are adults and 130 are kids. That's not too many busloads of kids on a per-day basis. And frankly, once the Exploratorium moves from the Palace of Fine Arts, I think we'll probably just get a lot of misguided people looking for the Exploratorium for the first couple of years, maybe, so we can piggyback on the coattails of that goodwill. Hey, honey, we're here already with the kids. I mean, it is a museum. But they happen to have pinball. What do you know? Yes.
If we were to locate at the auditorium, can you just tell us just a little bit about the parking facilities, hotels that are close by, that sort of thing?
Sure. The Exploratorium is located in the Marina District in San Francisco. It's very close to Crissy Field and within walking distance of the Golden Gate Bridge. And Lombard Avenue is known as Motel Row, so there's no shortage of motels nearby within walking distance, probably 3-4 blocks away.
Well, I spent most of the day Thursday in San Francisco, and it was difficult for
them. Yes, they've recently had an expansion of the pathway the roadway that leads from Crissy Field to the Golden Gate Bridge. They've widened the Doyle Drive project for the last year and a half to 2 years, so that did result in a slightly smaller parking lot. But there's more than ample room to park just across that main road at Crissy Field. All sorts of ample parking there. And the Exploratorium's never had a problem with their parking situation.
And it's free.
And it is free.
Yeah. It's funny. When we first announced that we were thinking about doing this, a lot of the people in San Francisco wrote on our Facebook saying, well, that would be horrible. You know, I live here in San Francisco, and I like driving over to Alameda. And if you put it here, that wouldn't be good, you know. And they go, besides, there's no parking out at the Exploratorium. And I go, wow, that's crazy, because there is parking. And I'm surprised how many people that lived in San Francisco didn't know about it. It's like it's behind the Exploratorium. They opened up this big lot, and it's been there for years. But I guess if you went to the Exploratorium, you know, 20 years ago, you might not know that there was that extra parking there. It was actually in the Presidio area, so it's kind of funny. Some of that's going to get eaten up by the roadway, but yeah, John.
You mentioned in the slideshow that it's going to take a hiatus next year, but I haven't heard any robust explanation.
Of why, or we hope, I mean, this is our hope, is by next year we'll be in some place where we can at least set up this many machines, and we're hoping that that's going to be the Palace of Fine Arts. Our secondary choice is going to be the Presidio, which is right next to the Palace of Fine Arts, as a basically a overflow museum for the Disney Museum. Disney Museum attracts so many people that it's just packed, and they actually need another venue to do that. Oh, yeah, Anna. Sorry. We do have the I'm waiting for Ron's cue. He's the Mr. Q guy.
Can we take one more question?
One more question. Oh, yeah, one more. Tim? Sure. The William Wiley project, that was interesting. And just to back up, just real quick, it was sold, the Visible Pinball was sold as an art piece from one museum to another, and Tim, you'll appreciate this little trick. In doing that, we paid no taxes on it. It was sold, it was the check was written to the Pacific Pinball Museum, and then and a little portion of that was given to me for, I built the first one totally on my own on my own nickel, and then I paid Wade a percentage off of that also. So, because Wade and I pretty much, you know, designed and built it. And so that was pretty cool. And it also established me as an artist, which is kind of neat. Your question about William Wiley, that was a project that produced, and I don't think a lot of people know this, produced the most expensive pinball machine ever made. They sold for $125,000 each. The last three of them, I believe they sold a total of six. And that was William Wiley, who's a very famous North American artist. And he made a machine called Punball. Jim Dietrich, who's on our board, runs Pinball Revival in Novato, teamed up with Wade, and they together produced the machine, which is based on a North Star. William Wiley did all the artwork. Wade screened it all on back glass and on the play field. And another artist, I forget his name, I think it was a letter number combination. What was it? Adam 2000 did the cabinetry and ended up showing it at a high-end art gallery. And they sold the first one we took to San Jose Art Gallery, and they snapped it up. It was out of all the things they were looking at that day for purchase. They only bought one, and it was the William Wiley pinball. And they bought it for $65,000, I think. Then the other ones went to the
Warhol Gallery?
No, it wasn't the Warhol Gallery. No, it was a gallery in San Francisco. Yeah. So the DeRosa Museum bought one. So they went on sale, and they all just got bought like that, with the last three going for $125,000 each. The prices kept going up when they kept selling them, and then by the time they hit the gallery, they were that high. They all got bought. The museum happens to have one example of the playfield and head. So we actually have a partial that my wife bought for the museum, I hope. Or for her own collection. The one thing is the museum kind of got started to get pinball out of my house so that I wouldn't end up divorced. And many years later, well, I care about my wife. I want her to be happy. And I saw a lot of pinball widows out there. So the concept was get the pins out of the house and wife will be happy. 9 years later, who comes home with her first pinball machine and puts it in the house? My wife. Now she's up to three. I like that. I think that's great. Okay, now we're going to show the Visible Pinball film. One last thing is Anna Newman. Anna Newman's been incredible. She came on to do the Pinball Donut Girl. She needed a place to shoot it, so we said, well, yeah, the warehouse. So they tried the museum, but that wasn't going to work. So we opened up the warehouse, and so Anna and she had a whole crew. She raised, also on Indiegogo, enough money to do this film, Pinball Donut Girl. And on a side project. She filmed Wade Krause Pinball Artist, and then she did a little thing about the visible pinball machine. So she's really kind of come into the pinball world, and I hope she hasn't been beaten up or scratched too badly. But we really appreciate all the work she's done, and she's also helping us with our Indiegogo fundraising and doing a little short for that. So at this point... He's right there.
Yes, David.
So back to the question that came up about future Expo. In a permanent location that would be this size or bigger, do you think there would still be some sort of annual or even more frequent event where there's a major gathering and there's seminars and vendors and it's sort of the event aspect of it as opposed to just having that many machines?
Well, I sure hope so. I don't want to speak for Mike, but I really hope so because this show's a lot of fun to put on. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I haven't had this much fun with my clothes on in a long time. And it only happens once a year. And I really would love to be doing it on an annual basis. If we don't do it on this scale, I think it might be fun to maybe have some sort of gathering or event at the museum itself, but target it maybe not to the general public, but just to a specific audience. One time a year, maybe target it to deep-pocketed, philanthropic-minded individuals who we know can help us out. Maybe another time to everyone else, or maybe just general pinball enthusiasts. But it certainly wouldn't be on, certainly I don't envision anything on the scale of what we're doing here. Again, it's just not fair to the games to move them around and like we do.
My question was, in a museum that would accommodate this size, there would always be 400 games.
Mm-hmm.
Would there still be an annual event at that location that would draw people who travel for this and not have, you know, a couple hundred people there every day, but
sure,
thousands of people coming for a special weekend?
Yeah, I would love to see that happen. I mean, just... We do intend to do that, and when I say we, I shouldn't speak for the board, but I'll vote yes for that.
Well, yeah, actually, when we were looking at the Naval Air Station, one of the ideas behind the smaller venue was to get that one up because it would be pretty a lot faster and easier to get it set up. But it wasn't the full size that we needed, but it had all this land around it. We bring out bands, you know, once a month. And let people, you know, there was actually a little campground where people could come in and they could camp. And we'd do, like, you know, monthly fundraisers out there where we could have bands playing. It overlooks the bay. And the idea was to continue, you know, these gatherings. So, yeah, if we did get a big space to put all the machines in, we'd definitely continue having these big events. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Sir.
I was going to ask you, I mean, the Exploratorium is a very large space, and of course they run, you know, Frank Oppenheimer has his workshop there, so there's a place to do work on machines, there's also an enormous display floor, and they regularly have events with quite a consequential number of people there, so if you're able to get that, it seems like you could host a really large group right there.
Oh yeah, no, that's the... That's one concept. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is the Exploratorium indeed did have this shop where they built the exhibits, had, you know, engine lathes and drill presses and all sorts of machinist stuff, welding equipment, and they even got a router, which they're probably going to have a hell of a time moving. But they set up a whole shop, and they had this little kind of curb wall over the whole thing. And I remember when management came down and go, they noticed that most of the shop guys were looking at the women coming in, you know, the moms. So they go, "We want you to build a wall in front of the shop," which was kind of abhorrent to everybody because they, you know, the idea was that visitors would come in and see this, and that was part of the whole experience, that you see the shop and you see that, hey, these are where these exhibits are made. But they wanted this wall put up because they didn't want some of the shop guys looking at that the moms coming in. So this engineer and shop guy said, "Okay, we'll build a wall," and they built it out of plexiglass. which I thought was really clever.
See-through plexiglass.
Yeah, see-through plexiglass. So the neat thing is that we'd love to, you know, if we got that space, we would keep that shop, because that would be part of the whole experience, is you get to see people restoring machines and working on them. Yeah.
I didn't get to hear what you might have said earlier, but are you in close contact with the members of the board of the Exploratorium?
It's not the members of the board of the Exploratorium that govern what happens to that space. That's governed by the Golden Gate Parks and Rec Department, and we have made forays into talking with them, and they are interested in what we're doing. That's why we got started on the fundraiser, because we realized, wow, if this goes where we're hoping it's going to go, we're going to need that kind of money just to throw down, just to get in the door.
I would still suggest that we speak to some of those folks.
Oh, yeah. No, we've spoken with Dennis Bartels, and we've been talking with Cassandra, who's actually with the Golden Gate Rex and Park people, because Dennis actually just told us to go, you should talk to these people. Those are the ones that are governing it. I still work for the Exploratorium. I freelance for them. So I still have a lot of connections over there. They are saying that there's a lot of money that would be needed for earthquake retrofit for a change of venue. Well, guess what? We're not. We're not a change of venue. There would be no change of use permit, because we're coming in as another museum. So that actually works really well in our favor, whereas some of the other organizations that are looking to get in there would not have that. They are going to put out an RFP, a request for proposals, and that's a process that we'll have to go through. Everybody will have to go through that. Generally, in these situations, they do listen. Well, they listen to two things. They listen to the public, and they listen to the money. There's when I say the money, there's money living on the hill overlooking the Exploratorium on that hill up there. They're part of the money that rebuilt the Exploratorium in the first place. So will they have a say-so? Yeah, I'm sure they will. I remember I took the little juju up to that hill, and Ann Getty came out and came into the little juju and played pinball. That was kind of neat. And what was really strange is that J. Paul Getty is the one who founded the Spartan Manor trailer. He bought up Spartan Aircraft back in 45 and started producing travel trailers, and here his granddaughter was on one of the trailers that he produced playing pinball. I thought, wow, this is getting Twilight Zone material.
Yes.
So I have two questions. One is, if you got this space tomorrow or in 6 months or something, do you guys have the resources to get all of the machines that you currently have up and displayable, or how long would that take? And then the second one was, at some point you mentioned something about memberships, and what is your position on that?
Your first question, the restoration process is going to go, I believe, well beyond, my lifetime, Larry's lifetime. There's a lot of work. There's a lot to do. So the idea is to set up the facilities. Right now, we have more machines. We didn't bring them all. So we would take all of those that we have out there now that are restored. And when I say restored, one of the things that we really need to do as a museum is bring in museum professionals. There's no handbook on how to restore a pinball machine, the do's and don'ts. But if you look at over some of the Smithsonian literature on what they do with artifacts, I'm sure there's things we're doing that they would, gasp at. Just working with the San Francisco Airport Museum, I felt a little ashamed at, the fact that we have them, we don't have them locked up in an airtight, I mean, the way they treat stuff, it's just they handle everything with gloves, and, they're kind of like, oh, you just pick that up with your hands? And, well, yeah. But I have been in the museum environment, and some of the people that gave me the toughest time were the ones that I really respect the most. I mean, I really didn't like working with them because they were real stringent, but they were right. When I see things altered, you know, that's wrong. It's historically incorrect. So if you're representing, you know, things from a historical and you want to be accurate, then you have to follow certain procedures. So it's going to take a long time to restore the whole collection, but it can be done and set up. I went to the Smithsonian Air and Space Restoration Facility, and I don't know how many they crank out. All I know is that they've got a backlog that goes out the, you know, way out the door and around the block a few times.
And then the membership question?
On the membership thing, what we did, we started off with a Lucky Juju Club card, which is just a way for frequent flyers to, you know, to get into the museum. Basically, it was $20. It lasted a year. It allowed you to come in for $10 every time, and you could get a friend in for $10. We're going to be changing that, kind of expanding it. I think we're going to ask more money for the one-year card. It's not going to be $20. I think I don't have exact numbers, but we're going to scale it up a little bit. And then we're going to have a couples card. We're going to have a family pass. And then we're going to have higher memberships that have nothing to do with really access to the museum. You just get access. And it's more about making a donation than it is a membership. But, yeah, the memberships will be coming online. I was hoping to have that ready for the expo, but we just didn't quite get it done in time. Joe, you had your hand up.
Well, let me see.
Uh-oh, you got a list? No, go ahead.
Well, it's just, let me see, okay, answer one. You said that there's a good chance you're going to get this Smithsonian Mountain, the Palace of Fine Arts over there.
Yeah.
And that's going to be our best choice. Of course, it's like the Naval Air Station, because it's not big enough and it's near salt water anyway. That would be another thing.
No, the main problem with the Naval Air Station and all the work that we put into the Alameda area, and the reason I was doing this was because I was looking, well, what can we afford? We can't afford much. Why don't we pick something that nobody wants and see if we can fix it up with our sweat equity? So that was the concept behind that, and we got pretty far. The problem was the city. I went in, you know, with I thought was an incredible deal for any landlord. I mean, hey, we'll fix your building up, and then just let us use it for 5 years, and then you can have it back, you know, and then we're going to move on to a bigger one. That was the first concept. We'll charge you rent from the beginning, and blah, you know, it's, what? And then the second one is, oh, we'll just take this big building, and we'll refurbish it and everything. And at that point, they just said, well, you know, no thanks. Or, you know, it's gonna be 15 years before anybody's out here. So they just basically said no. And they either gave us a deal that was no good or that wouldn't work for us. What they did do was they gave us, and this just happened before we left with the last load on the truck, I got a letter from the city with a letter of intent to give us a 5-year extended lease on our warehouse and a roof. So that's fantastic news for us because we have this 12,000 square foot warehouse that's on a year-to-year lease and doesn't do too much for your, you know, security, long-term security. So we're the first people on the Naval Air Station to get a 5-year lease. It's pretty amazing. And it's just because I kept hammering on them, and finally I shamed them. Like, shame on you, City of Alameda.
Oh, yes, I do actually recall you saying that before, Mike.
Yeah. That's
the thing.
No, that's right.
Well,
you get one more question. One more question. You got one?
Yeah, well, yeah, what's the STEM stand for? I saw in the video picture, but I couldn't see.
Oh, STEM stands for, and actually it's changing into STEAM. It's STEM stand for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, and now they've changed it to Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. And that's... It's basically a buzzword that educational institutions use to get their grants. The focus right now, because America's lagging behind other countries in their educational processes, so they're trying to shore that up with those kind of programs.
Yeah, you know, I think probably Larry was right. Probably we are going to do the best thing in San Francisco, even if it's... Well, not just me, but for other people who have to come from the East Bay to travel over, even if it does prove to be a little bit of an inconvenience, it probably will still be the best, probably.
Not if we get our next grant would be for a pneumatic tube that would shoot people over there from wherever they are. I've always envisioned that pneumatic tubes were the wave of the future, and that's my next project. Well, you laugh now, but when you're shooting through that tube to the museum, you won't be laughing.
But thank you again for coming out, folks. We really appreciate it.